Hey, good to see you. Thank you for all being here. It's always nice to see so many smiles. And Pastor Math Reed. Clive, were you the only person that said yes? I think you could have been, so thank you. Respect to you there, Clive. Thank you. Paul, please sit down, Paul. I have the microphone. So, do you ever walk past newsagents and see those sandwich boards that have what's meant to be an eye-grabbing headline? And the headline's meant to make you think, I really want to go in and buy that newspaper. I want to know more about that story. Do you ever walk past those sandwich boards, see the headlines and think, man, they are struggling for news? I just want to show you a couple of examples that I'm thinking there's not a lot going on in those particular places. Mystery of restaurants exploding tea towels. Sometimes you get the impression they just feel they have to exaggerate something to be eye-catching, to sensationalize it, or indeed Friday, one day until the weekend lands. If there's no real news, just say something painstakingly obvious and maybe people will buy your newspaper. Let's face it, they're a bit rubbish, aren't they? They're a bit rubbish. But my eye came across some news headlines this last week that were taking rubbish to a new level. Just put the next one on, Jamie. I mean, I don't know if you can see that. I mean, see... Clambletheian's new litter bin is welcomed. Because who wouldn't want to read that in a newspaper? If you are from that area, and if you're listening on the podcast, all power to you. Because you are getting excited over a new litter bin. Next one, Jamie. Okay, I mean, I don't... You can only imagine what he's after. Man freed after getting his head stuck in a bin in Aberdeen. And some of this writing's a bit small at the bottom, so I just want to tell you, firefighters were called out to rescue a man whose head was stuck in a public litter bin in Aberdeen. It's not yet known how the man got into the predicament, which happened on the city's Justice Street. Is there a bit of irony there in the name of that street? I don't know. Next one, please, Jamie. This is my favourite. Poor Alf. Poor guy. Alf, 91 years old, confuses disposal bin for nearby postbox. So Alf says, I've been posting my letters in the dog poo box for 2 years. And you wonder what he's been posting. Maybe he's won the pools and he was posting his, or the lottery. And he was posting his claim and he's been waiting 2 years saying, where's my money? And if you see, there's a little circle in the background on that picture where it's actually circling. Can you see that? Yeah. It's actually circling where the real red postbox is. Bless his cotton socks. Poor old Alf. But the common theme, of course, literally is rubbish, isn't it? Because they've all got something to do with rubbish bins. And listen, you'd say that off now, Jamie. So I decided to bring my own bin along today. This is our litter basket. This is our little basket. Thank you. And you know, as Joe will tell you, it's my job, one of my jobs in our house, one of my many jobs, is to empty the bins. So when a bin gets full, it's my job to be the bin assessor and assess how high that bin, has it reached critical mass. Could you balance another piece of litter on the top and it not fall off? Because that's the rule, isn't it? That's the rule. The rule is when you put litter in a bin, if you can't physically put any more in, if it falls off, then actually the bin is officially full. But we've discovered something in our house. If you sit on it or squash it or put your foot in it, Then it'll compress it down, and then more will fit in the bin. And so my job is to assess, oh, is that bin full? And I'll try and squeeze it. And then I think, well, maybe it's full. So then you do that thing where you take the bag out, and the bag is far bigger than the receptacle that it's in, isn't it? And all the rubbish drops down, and you go, that's a waste of a bin bag. I'll keep that another 2 days. And you shake it around a bit, and you squash it down until eventually that bin is officially full. And this is a real trauma for me. Because I know that if I come with that last piece of litter, that critical mass, it's going to tip the balance between the bin being nearly full and really full, then whatever litter I have in my hand, even if it's a tiny piece of litter, I'm then going to have to take the bin bag out. I'm going to have to go out. It's probably going to be raining. It's probably going to be cold. Got to go out to the wheelie bin. It's sadder than that. And then I've got sometimes the wheelie bin's full, so sometimes I have to get a chair from the garden to stand in the chair, to climb into the wheelie bin, to tread it down, this is true, to squash it down so that I can fit another bag in, and then I come back. After that, all I want is a bit of appreciation. Anybody understand that? No, not now. Not now. Well, thank you very much, because that's appreciated. When I've then put a fresh bin bag in and the whole of the trauma is over, I usually just stand by the bin for a few minutes. And I wait to see if Joe's going to walk past. Because sometimes what happens then is when Joe walks past and she'll see me stand, she'll look at this silly, smug, childish grin on my face, and I'm kind of... And she'll look at, oh, you've emptied the bin, have you? And I go, yeah. And she'll give me a little pat on the head. Well done, love. And then it's all worth it. Because that is my job. But as every guy will tell you, they like a little bit of appreciation. So, head of household maintenance and bin emptying, that's me. I'm just going to keep this with me for a while. That's okay. I just want to read a bit of a passage where you're saying, what's this got to do with the Bible? I'll tell you what it's got to do with the Bible. Luke 6, 37. Don't worry if you're not going to read it to you. Luke 6, verse 37. How many of you have heard this passage before? Do not judge, and you will not be judged. Do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over, will be poured into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. So this passage, and in particular this phrase that says about this pressed down and shaken together, this comes from Levitical law. So this comes from the Old Testament. It's the way that poor people used to reap in the fields. Because God said in the Old Testament, listen, there's a lot of poor people around. And they haven't got money to go and buy food in the shop. So if you own a field, when you harvest your field, you must leave a margin around the edge. And that margin is not for you to harvest. That's for the poor people. They will come and they will harvest around the edge. Now, the poor people, they turn up with some kind of receptacle, maybe a sack or a basket usually. And in that basket, they would collect what was left around the edge of the field and they would put it in their basket. And of course, if you're a poor person, it's in your own interest to fit as much as you can in your basket. So the poor people would reap around the edge of the field and they would put it in a basket and they would press it down and they'd shake it around a bit like that and they'd make it full and they'd pack it down. And then that basket was completely full. Now, I know that's the way that poor people reaped, but it was not the way that workers reaped, because the workers who did the harvest did not have any interest in how well they packaged it into the basket. Because if you were a worker, you got paid per hour or per day. However efficiently you packed into your basket did not matter, because you would still get paid the same amount of money at the end of the day. Does that make sense? So if you're poor, if you don't put enough in your basket, you're going to starve. So you really, really, I mean really, packaged it down like we did with our bin in our house before it goes out. You shake it and it drops down, but literally, you would fill your basket, and that is how the poor people would reap. And if you're like me, you've probably heard this passage before. It's not a new passage. In fact, quite often you'll hear churches and the leaders at the front, quite often comes out in various churches all over the world when it comes time for an offering or when it comes time to give some money. And the person at the front will say, give, and it will come back to you, good measure, press down, shake it together, running over. And we'd all nod and we'd all go, yeah, yeah, heard this message before. I've got a question for you. Is that passage then only to do with money? Give and it will be given to you. What is it? What is give? Well, give is a verb. Give is something that you do. Then it says, give and it will be given back to you. It is anything. Yeah. It is whatever you give. You see, we think the passage says, Jesus was saying, give money and money will be given back to you. But it is anything you give. Yeah. It includes money, but it's so much more than just giving money. And this passage, if you look at the context, and this is why it's so important to look at Bible passages in context. It starts off talking about do not condemn and you will not be condemned. Do not judge, forgive. Now, they're not physical things. They're not like a £10 note or a check. But what this passage is saying, that they can still be given and they will still come back. Give and it. It is anything you give. Now, there's a kind of a secular law for this. You won't find it in the Bible, but even people in the real world understand this law. It has a name. It's called the law of circulation. Some of you may have heard this law. This is the law of circulation, okay? The law of circulation says, it states that things in the universe are always flowing. What you give to one person, you will receive back, but from a different source. So when you give, you don't have to give with the expectation you're going to get back from the same person. But you know that it will definitely come back to you, multiplied, from other sources. Yeah. This is the law of circulation. And this is a pretty good analogy and an explanation as to what this passage is trying to get across. So take forgiveness, for example. Give forgiveness. Yeah. Forgive and you will be forgiven. Give forgiveness. I think you'd all agree, and some of you know what I'm talking about here. Forgiving is not the same and is not as easy sometimes as writing a check. Because if you want to forgive somebody, you have got to make the mental decision to say, I am going to forgive. And what happens is that over a period of time, your head, which is saying, I'm going to forgive, I'm going to forgive, I'm going to forgive, brings your heart along for the journey, and eventually your heart moves into alignment with what your mind is saying. Because Jesus said in Matthew 6, he actually said, your heart follows wherever you put your treasure. And by treasure, he's saying what you value, what you rate highly, what you consider important. So your heart, what this tells me is that your heart is a follower, it's not a leader. Your heart is a pupil, it's not a teacher. Your heart doesn't do the instructing. Your heart is instructed. Your heart waits to see where you will place your treasure, and it goes, oh, okay, that's where we're going. That's what we treasure, is it? Right, I'm going to come along on the journey with you, and I'm going to move to where you put your treasure. That's what your heart does. When you read the story in Mark 12:41 about the widow. You probably know the story if I explain it to you. There's a poor widow, and Jesus is sitting next to the temple treasury where they're giving their offerings to the temple, and Jesus is watching what they put in. And this widow who's poor, she comes along, and she basically puts the equivalent of, you know, a few copper coins in. It's practically worthless by the standards of the day. And Jesus says she gave more than anybody else who gave large sums of money. Now, of course, he wasn't counting the monetary amount, was he, when he said that? He was measuring the heart. He was saying she gave from her heart more. She She loved God more. She was more sacrificial. She was more generous than the rich people who had loads to give. And so even though they gave large amounts, it didn't really cost them much. When the guys in our church take up the money that we put in the offering, we've already done the offering today, that has to be counted. It's got to be bagged up, it's got to be banked. When those guys count the money, all we can do is we can count the physical amount that people can give. We count that total. But what we can't do when we count up your money is we can't count the heart. Yeah. Only God can count the heart. And that's what Jesus was talking about when he talked about the widow giving more. He was counting her heart. You could give 10p with an immensely generous giving heart. Or you could give £1,000 from a begrudging heart. And I got to tell you, as I understand it from the Bible and what Jesus said, the person who gives 10p from a right mindset and a giving, loving heart is going to receive more back in life than the person who gives £1,000 from a withholding, begrudging heart. Because that's the way that God has wired things and wired life. Because giving changes hearts. Yes. Give and it. Anything you give will change your heart. That's why God is so interested in it. It doesn't have to be money. It's anything. And if we in the church don't try and give you a balanced view on teaching on giving, then who will? The banks, the building societies, the payday loan companies, your boss, your job, your work, your previous financial history. I don't think that if we miss this opportunity in church to try and give you a balanced view on giving and how it affects the heart and how it is so important in trying to get out of you what God put in you, then I don't think we can trust on anybody else to give a reliable, balanced view. And it's why we agreed when Joe and I took on the church a few years ago, we said, listen, we at least once a year, let's just say one time a year, we're just going to preach on giving. Not from a position of weakness. Yeah. Not from a position of the church, we need your money. Churches can do that. Churches have got a bad track record on that. Because churches can play on your heartstrings. They can take passages out of context. They can take your money, but that's emotional. And sometimes it's blackmail. And the best that will do is change your attitude for a day. Yeah. But it's not a long-term solution. So we always agreed. We said, we are not going to come at it from that approach that we need your money and we want to spend your money. Because that is not what God is after. Absolutely. It's not what God's interested in. God doesn't care about actually your money. God doesn't need your money. No. God created it. He doesn't need your money. Jesus said in Matthew 26, you can't serve God and money because they're both masters and they'll both master you. But you can serve God with your money. And whether you know it or not, every one of us in here, every single person here has a money attitude. And whether you evaluate your thoughts on that or not, it's still true. We all have an attitude towards money. For many of us, the attitude has been put in us when we were children, when we were growing up. Some of you may know this. I grew up in a poor household. So I had a brother and a sister, and my mum and my dad and me. So the five of us, we were not rich by any stretch of the imagination. I would go so far as to say we were poor. We were not breadline poor, so we always had the money to eat. But there was rarely anything left over after that for any kind of extravagance. And I remember one day walking into the living room, and I remember looking at the coffee table in the living room where my dad had mindlessly dropped his bank statement for that month. And I, just out of interest, as a little lad, picked up the bank statement. I wasn't that old, but I was old enough to read, and I was old enough to get money. And I remember looking at the bank statement, and I remember the shock when I saw how much we were overdrawn by my dad's bank account. I was actually, for the first time in my life, financially scared. Not because it was my job. But I remember getting a piece of paper and a crayon, sitting down at the dining table, which was the only table we had in the house, sitting down and making a list of everything we spent money on. Everything that I spent money on. So I wrote down sweets. I spent money on sweets. 8p on a copy of the Beano. Anybody remember the Beano? 8p on a copy. Wrote that down on the list. And I said, oh, it's not all about me, is it? I know we spend money on food, so I wrote down food. And I remember we spend money on these bills. What bills? Okay, there's a gas fire. We probably spend money on gas, and we have coal. And I wrote down this list, quite an extensive list for a little lad. And I took it to my mum and dad in the kitchen, and I held up this piece of paper. I said, Mum, Dad, I've just seen the bank statement, and I know that we've not got enough money. And so I've done a list here of all the things that we spend money on. And if you think that you can tell me any of these things that I can help on to spend less money on, you tell me, and I will spend less money on this. And I remember my mum and dad looking at me, and they said, Matthew, it's not your job to be worried. Yeah. It's our job to be worried. And you see, that didn't help. Because all that told me is that money was something to worry about. And I remember going away thinking, there's nothing I can do. And in that kind of environment, that childhood environment, what I had taken away from that was a lack mentality. I was kind of worried. I believed at that point in my life, and many of you will get what I'm saying. If you have a lack mentality, you believe that life is riddled with lack and limitation. And you think that there's only so much to go around. And so you better take it, because if you don't take it, somebody else will. That is a lack mentality. And many of us here today, this morning, were brought up with that kind of lack mentality. Now, psychiatrists tell us that most of your established mental processes are in place by the time you are 8 years old. So by the time you are 8 years old, if that's the kind of lack environment you were brought up with as a child, you may be 48, 58, 68 now, and you still don't get why you still have this mentality, this money mindset of lack. Let me tell you the opposite of a lack mindset. The opposite of a lack mindset or a lack mentality is an abundant mentality. An abundant mentality says that the universe always provides more than enough. And because it provides more than enough, I don't have to fight for. I don't have to withhold, be stingy, be selfish, hold on to. Because there is always more than enough. An abundant mentality says, I don't begrudge you having more than me. I don't begrudge you being successful and financially well off, because I know that it doesn't affect the amount that God can bless me. I know it doesn't affect how much can still come to me if I build a generous lifestyle. So the way that every one of us thinks about money is deeply, I mean deeply, rooted in our psyche. I have seen few things in society that stir as many emotions as money or the lack of money, or the greed and want of more money. Money is deeply rooted. And so if you look at somebody who's got a lot of money and you're cynical about the fact they're rich, or it's all right for them, they've got a lot of money. Phew. He's got money to throw around. She just spends it like there's no... If you resent people who have money, here's the issue with that. If you have a problem with someone having more money than you, you will always struggle to become one of them. Let me give you a verse of scripture that goes with that. Proverbs 28:22 says, the stingy are eager to get rich, but unaware that poverty awaits them. So you'll often find people saying, I want more money. I want to be rich. But in their heart, they're stingy. In their heart, they're saying, well, I've got a lack mentality. And so even though they're trying to get themselves around people who might get the money to them, and even though they're trying to hold on to the money that they've got, ultimately, poverty awaits them. You know, rich people have bills just the same as poor people, right? They just have more zeros on them. Everybody has bills. You can't avoid bills. You can't change bills, but you can change your ability to pay them. Just to bear with me on this, just to gauge how you feel about money and about my question about how you feel about money. Ask yourself this question now. This is between you and God. I don't want to know your answer. Ask yourself this question. How do you feel when you are forced to spend money? I don't mean on things you like. I don't mean like on a holiday or you know, going out or some new clothes, because that's a no-brainer, because we all love that. We all love spending money on nice things. I mean money you have to pay, like bills. How do you feel when you have to pay bills? Do you resent paying bills? Do you delay paying them because you resent them? Do you whinge and do you do drama about your bills to those around you who will listen? Do you get mad when brown envelopes come through the door as if they're a conspiracy theory only against you? Do you get mad and put them in a special place, like a drawer at home, and you put the bills, you open the drawer, you put the bills in the drawer, and you close it, and you kind of give it a wide berth, and every now and again, you open the drawer, and you say something to it like it's a person, then you shut the drawer, and you walk. You have this relationship with the drawer. Do you resent the people who send the bills to you as if you think they have a personal vendetta against you? We had a pile when we were at home, a pile by the door, on a little table by the front door. It was a pile. This pile was like massive. And in this pile was everything that came through the letterbox. So there was junk mail, there was correspondence, and there was letters, and there was telephone directories. Do you remember the days when telephone directories used to be big? I mean, one came through our door the other week. It's pathetic. Do you remember when tearing a telephone directory in half was a test of strength for Britain's strongest man? The massive telephone directories in yellow pages. We had them in the pile as well. We had a few years' worth. Not just what, like old ones. And this pile grew. Now, I can only assume that this pile was there because of my dad's mentality that maybe if you slip in the odd bill in this pile, then the effect of the rest of the correspondence there waters it down. A bit like if you have cordial, you know, your juice, you add water to it. You put too much water to it, you can't really taste the juice. And I think my dad thought that about bills. I think he thought, if I build up this pile, then I can ignore the few bills in there because they're only a small percentage of the pile. And so as you came in through the door, the first thing you saw was this pile. But it was kind of like the elephant in the room. Everybody gave it a really wide berth. And you did not talk about the pile to my dad. If you raised the issue of the pile, you knew that conversation would not end well. And this pile kind of bothered me for two reasons. The first reason it bothered me was because what if it's your birthday and somebody's posted your birthday card and it comes through the letterbox? If you're not there to grab it straight away, it gets absorbed into the pile. And the only way you're ever going to see that birthday card again, it might have a fiver from your godmother in it. The only time you're going to see that, you have to tackle the pile. And the second thing that used to worry me about this pile is I'd read news stories about hoarders. You ever seen them in bed? They gather like piles of newspapers. And you read stories about the fact that they go missing. And they're buried under a pile of newspapers that fell on them in the house. And nobody sees them for 3 weeks. And I'm thinking, if that pile falls on me, I'm a goner. Nobody's going to hear about me from 3 weeks. This pile scared me. But I also knew that one of the reasons why we had the pile was because our family had a lack mentality. We were actually scared about bills. Here's why I ask you that question about how you feel about money. If you have a problem with letting money go from you, you will always experience difficulty in money coming to you. Wow. Proverbs 11:24. Just so you know, I'm not making this up. One person gives freely, yet gains even more. Another withholds unduly, but comes to poverty. What that's saying is that money comes to you as it goes from you. So one person, he has an abundant mentality. He gives freely. He knows that it doesn't matter if I give because I know there's this law of circulation and I know that eventually it's going to come back to me from different sources. But another guy, he withholds. He has a lack mentality. He tries to keep hold of what he's got because he says, if I give a tenner, I'm going to be worse off. That is a lack mentality. And Solomon, the wisest guy who ever lived, the king who wrote that proverb, do you know, if I'm going to decide between him teaching me on giving and the world's teaching on giving, I'm going to go for him every time. The man with the lack mentality still ended up with nothing, even though he tried to hold on to what he had. What a weird mindset is that compared to the world's thinking of that you've got to get all you can all you get, and sit on the can. The principle of life is that money comes to you as it goes from you. Yeah. It's a flow. It's a flow. In the year 1900, in America, in the American state of California, the area was a big desert, very difficult to grow anything there. And the people in that land said, do you know, if only we could get a bit of water into this land, we could use all this desert to grow crops. And so what they did was they went to the river that runs reasonably close, the Colorado River. And they dug some channels, some tributaries from this river to this dry, parched, arid land, so that they could start to grow things. And for a few years, it worked. This area that was desert started to grow crops. But in 1905, just as the mountains were melting their ice, which was contributing to a stronger flow in the Colorado River than usual, there was extra rainfall that nobody anticipated. The river flooded. It broke its banks, and the water was looking for somewhere to go. And the only place that the water could go was down these tributaries and channels that the farmers and the people had dug. And the water flew down it into the desert basin. And it completely, I mean completely, flooded hundreds and hundreds of square miles of flood water. It took them 2 years to stop the river leaking. That's how bad the flow of water was. And after 2 years, everybody looked at this lake that was where the desert used to be. They called it Salton Lake. And everybody thought, well, this is a desert. It's going to dry up, isn't it? It's hot, it's dry. The water's going to disappear. But after a few years, it was still there. So people thought, huh, maybe it's going to stick around. And a number of years later, some people got the idea, well, this is a desert, but here's a lot of water. Let's create a holiday resort. And so on the banks of Salton Lake, they built holiday resorts. And they built it. They had this advertising slogan. They said, it's a miracle in the desert. And it worked. People flocked from miles around. People came to this lake. They stocked it with fish. And the story goes that if you cast a fishing line into the lake, you didn't even need to put bait on your hook. You would still catch fish. And so everything was great. 1950s, early 1960s, brilliant holiday resort. You could get a postcard. There's sites on the internet all about it. Everything was going well. That is, until the lake turned. You see, Salton Lake is 70 meters below sea level. It's one of the lowest places in North America. And what was happening is water was flowing off the farmers' lands, the fields. And those fields contained an amount of salt. So when it rained, the rain ran off the fields and washed the salt into the freshwater lake. But because the lake was so low, and as you all know, water doesn't naturally flow uphill, the water had nowhere to get out of the lake. So even if you tried to dig a little bit of a canal, it still had nowhere to go because the canal would be uphill. So the salt increased the saltiness of the lake. And as the years went by, water evaporated from the sun, but it never flew out of the lake. And as the salt increased and increased and increased, and eventually it became as salty as the normal sea, and it still carried on increasing, became more salty and more salty, until eventually the fish could not survive and there was mass fish die-off. Thousands of fish washed up onto the bank of this lake with the horrible, horrible smell that that brings. Not only that, but the saltiness of the water created these strange brown algae formations called algal blooms, which also let off a rotten smell. Well, it's no surprise. People left. And you can go there and visit the banks of Salton Lake today. You can smell the smell. You can see a ghost town where people had abandoned boats and buildings and property just to get away. Because the lake was taking water in. There was a way in, but there was no way to get out. And without the outflow, the lake could not hold life. Yeah. And it's a principle of life that stuff flows from you as it comes to you. But if you withhold, like the proverb says, if you withhold, if you do not let it flow out, you come to poverty. Money flows to you as it flows from you. So let's go back to this idea of an abundance mindset, an abundant heart, an abundant mentality. How do we get an abundant lifestyle? Well, the good news is this. You don't need to own anything to feel abundant. Yeah. You don't need to own anything. Yeah. The source of all abundance does not come from outside you. Yeah. It is within you. Yeah. Now, many of us, we've got a dormant abundancy within inside us. It's there. Yeah. It's ready to come out, but it hasn't been awakened yet. And it starts with small things. And each and every one of us can begin to waken up the feeling of abundancy. Simple things, like giving a smile. Yeah. Kids do it. Like opening a door. Enjoying a sunset. Anybody else still like that? Is that just me? Sunrise, sunset, anybody else love that? Red skies, lovely. Enjoying thunderstorms, getting drenched in the rain, biting into your favourite fruit. Smell of fresh cut grass, changing seasons and the colours of it. It costs you nothing. Yeah. But if you can't appreciate simple things like that, I question whether you've got this idea of what an abundant heart is all about. Some of us, in a money-driven, materialistic world, we're unhappy. Even though we've got everything we need, we're unhappy. Be careful how you teach your kids about money. Yeah. Be careful how you bring up your kids, because some kids, and I see this as a teacher, and I see this in my walks of life, some kids are so spoiled with what they have that they get no joy anymore in some stuff that the kid down the street would think they'd died and gone to heaven to get. Yeah. Teach your children to enjoy simple things. How great is this food? Good luck on that battle. How much is this running water, this tap, this shower running through your hair? Bad example. How great is this water? Shoes. Aren't those shoes on your feet lovely? A warm coat in winter? Yeah, zip it right up, Mum, Dad. Appreciation of simple things. Yeah. My kids like playing in the garden. They like climbing trees. They like digging for worms. They like running away from the waves at the seaside and building sandcastles. Simple things. Now, don't get me wrong. They like treats. And they like it when we buy them presents. So I'm not going overboard too far one way. I'm just trying to strike a balance here. But what always gets me most weeks is when, you know, sometimes you guys don't know this, sometimes I'm nearly late to church. The reason I'm nearly late to church is just because we're about to walk out the door and I think I've got everything ready. And Caitlin goes, Daddy, can I just go back and get something? And I'm like, Caitlin, I told you, you had to get everything 10 minutes ago. Daddy, I just want to go to my money box and get some money for collection. And she'll count out the coins and she'll say, I want that one. I'm going to take that one. Because we've taught her that giving is important. And as a family, we don't take those kind of things for granted. And I won't let them forget, because I'm dad. If you begin to cultivate an appreciation of simple things that we usually take for granted, you will begin to build an abundance on the inside. Yeah. And when you do that, stuff, it, whatever you give, stuff will begin to flow to you as it flows from you. Proverbs 11, 25 says a generous man will prosper, and we get that the wrong way around. So a lot of us think, well, I'll give when I've got more. That's not what the Bible says. The Bible says a generous man will prosper, not a prosperous man will be generous. Not, I'll, you know, yeah, I'm a bit skint this month. I'll leave it a little bit. No, no, no. Because prosperity follows generosity. Some people go, I've got nothing. You can't expect me to give anything. I've got nothing to give. That is not true. Yeah, but I've got no money. I'm not talking about money. Abundance doesn't begin with writing a check. Abundance begins with giving your life away. Yeah. It's got to start there. It's got to start with something simple, because if you can't give simple things away and enjoy simple things, then of course you're going to struggle with writing a check. Yeah. And an abundant heart says, I have no more trouble in giving £10 than I do shaking a hand, than I do opening a door for somebody, than I do for giving a lift. Give and it will be given to you. Like I say, we've got this so wrong, church. We have taught this so badly in previous years. All across the world, people have not got this message. Some people are going, oh, give. Yeah, give and it'll come back. So although we're giving, we're all on the take and we're all doing it because we want more. So we say, right, if I put a penny in the God slot, then the vending machine of God is going to give me out more than I ever got. And God's saying, you got it wrong, church. You got it all wrong. I don't need you to give because I need your money. I don't need you to give because I need your money to support the church. If I want to support the church, I can provide for my people. He's done it before. In the Old Testament, with all the people, the entire generation of Israelites going through the desert, fed by manna from heaven. In Kings, in the book of Kings, you will read about the prophet Elijah in 1 Kings. And God sends a raven with meat in its beak to feed his prophet Elijah. A raven, incidentally, is a meat-eating bird. So the fact that the raven did not eat the meat that it dropped is saying something. In the New Testament, Jesus told Peter to go and catch a fish and look in the fish's mouth. And in the fish's mouth was a coin, and that coin was used to pay the temple taxes. We've got to work out where them suckers swim, haven't we? Yeah, a fishing party. Richard, you got your rods. Fishing party down Louth Canal. We'll hunt them blighters out, won't we? Where do they swim? The point is, God doesn't need us to give to support the church. He needs us to give to get out of us what was inside us, and he wants to get us to where we need to be and where our heart needs to travel to. And what's killing all of us, people all around the world, is this selfish, withholding mindset. I mean, societies, they're breaking down. People, you read stories, they're stabbing people over a few quid. This family's breaking down. Crimes being committed just for a few pounds, because people are saying, if I don't take it, if I don't grab it, then it won't come back to me. Yes, it will. If you give, it will come back to you. If you give with an abundant lifestyle, it will come back to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over. What you sow will come back. Yeah. We're out of time. If you can get, I hope this is speaking to some of you. If you can get this idea of abundance and an abundant mindset, it starts from inside, guys. It really does. Just small things. You know, giving a smile, especially when you're going through a hard time. Just giving a smile. I mean, let's not exaggerate it. It's not a flow. It's just a drip. But the habit with drips is that they tend to turn into a flow. Brilliant. And the flow becomes a river, and the river becomes a torrent. And before you know it, just like Jesus, your life becomes one continuous flow of abundance. And the feeling of abundance, it always results in stuff coming to you. Abundance is not a gesture. It's not a one-off event. It's not a one-off activity. It is a belief system. So, give from the heart. God is so interested, church, so interested in changing your heart. And if you give it, whatever you give, it includes money, but it is so much more. Give and it will come back to you. A good measure. I mean a good measure. Not your piddly measures. Not your pants, but your good measure. Press down. Shaken together running over. Church, starting today, starting this week, yeah, let's build an abundant heart. Awesome. Bless you guys. God bless.